All right, welcome to the Fit Vegan Podcast. I'm your show host, Maxim Sigouin, and I'm the founder and CEO of Fit Vegan Coaching, a company that is on a mission to help 10,000 people get lean, thrive, and reduce their risk of chronic illnesses by 2033 and a million by 2050. I believe that having a fit, healthy body and mind is the foundation to living an incredible life, and this is what the show will give you if you choose to listen and implement. Enjoy the episode and have a great day. All right. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Fit Vegan Podcast. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest, Tim Kaufman, who's the creator of Fat Man Rants. So you're diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome in early 20s and spent most of his life in chronic pain. By age 37, he was addicted to fentanyl, alcohol, and fast food. At over 400 pounds, he was unable to perform simple daily tasks, and now he's racing Ironman and completely turned his life around. Tim, welcome to the show, brother.
Maxime, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for all the good that you do to make the world a better place.
Thank you. Appreciate that. So, man, I want to dive into your story because, you know, we had the opportunity to connect on your show a few weeks back. So I'm happy that we get to return the favor and have you on here. So, man, like, let's get started to this. Like, what came first? Like, you wanting to turn your life around or veganism?
No. Actually, neither. I had no intention of turning my life around because I thought that I had been dealt a set of cards and this was just what life was going to be and this is how I was going to die. And I was pretty much, I guess, okay with that. I had just come to grips with that. So let me go back and tell you how I got to that point, if you don't mind.
Yeah. Yeah, and explain what EDS is as well for the listeners and for myself too. I'm not too sure.
Yeah, so I'll just give a little bit of background. I still live in a rural town. It's not as rural as it was, you know, 30 years ago, but it's called Alden, New York, and we're about 20 miles east of Buffalo. And so I grew up in farm country, and I got a job like all the other kids in the neighborhood on a farm, dairy farm. We milked about between 70 and 100 cows, kind of like the old fashioned way. So it wasn't very automated. It was obviously a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
Along with growing up in this area, hunting, fishing, raising our own animals, all part of our culture, just how I was brought up as a little kid. That's the only thing I knew. I didn't really know anything different than hunting and fishing. That's what we did for fun when we weren't working. But, you know, and I started actually on the farm at 13 years old. And, you know, through my early teens, I kept getting hurt all the time. And, you know, my dad just thought I was a klutz and I thought I was like accident prone. I was always like twisting my ankles. I'd pick stuff up and like pop my wrist out. And I just thought I was clumsy. And as time went on, I felt like I got more clumsy. My high school sweetheart, I think we started dating when I was 13. We've been married 31 years and together 36. So it's been a bit. We were planning on getting married. I actually ended up dropping out of high school because she had graduated a year ahead of me and we wanted to start a life together. So I needed a better job. So I got a job in a factory where I started working over my head more. And all of a sudden, my shoulder starts popping out of the socket every time I reach up for a crane pendant. And, you know, I tried to just like push it off and put it off. But it got to the point where just a sneeze, just the pressure in my chest would dislocate my shoulder. And I'd like physically, manually have to pop it back in place to keep working. And it just got looser and looser to the point where I finally, you know, broke down and called the doctor. They took some tests on it. And he said, well, you're going to need an arthroscopy on your shoulder. They're going to cut my back open and take all the cords, you know, the tendons and kind of like pull them out, fold them over, stitch them up to tighten all those strings back up. When they got in there, they started pulling on stuff and it just kept stretching and stretching and stretching, almost like bubble gum, he described it as. And then when they stitched me up, the scar tissue just like blew out and it was really weird. And that's when I was diagnosed with this disease called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. So basically it's a genetic screw up the collagen or the glue that holds my body together is like bubblegum, and it's very stretchy, super stretchy. So all my joints became loose. And, you know, when I was young, it probably wasn't so much of a big deal. But when I got older, I had, you know, by my late teens, I was already loaded with arthritis from all the damage, like, you know, all these little micro subluxations. Yeah. They put little, you know, divots and stuff in my cartilage, and that started breaking down. So it became very painful. The prognosis, here I am, newly married, 20 years old, and a kid on the way. And they were filling out disability papers for me. I was a big, tough guy. Mm-hmm. You know, I was all about protecting and providing for my wife and my family. And now a doctor's telling me I'm going to be disabled. I'm permanent disability. The instructions were to go home, keep my body as quiet as I possibly could, make sure that I was always supported. And they started just putting splints all over my body and braces. And it was not a good place emotionally for me to be. I didn't end up filling out those disability papers. I healed up and went back to work. But one of the other things that happened through that surgery was I was introduced to narcotics. I had never really taken medicine. My family was a bunch of tough people that, you know, medicine was for weak people. So we didn't hardly go to the doctor. And I started taking Lortabs, and they were super effective, very effective. They made me feel good. They kind of like mellowed me out a little bit. And I'll speed this part up so we can get through this. It's not the funnest thing to talk about, but as you know, with any narcotic, you know, once, you know, you never get the same effect as the first time. And through the months and the years, you know, we kept upping the dosage and then eventually upping the type of medicine. So I went from Lortab to Percocet to Oxycontin, which at the time there was an epidemic and doctors were handing that out like candy. And it's highly addictive. And so I became an addict, and I didn't even realize it was happening. I probably wouldn't admitted that it was happening even when I was taking, you know, upwards of 100 tablets a week. Sometimes, you know, I got to the point where I was taking 30, 40 tablets a day. You know, that obviously took some time to progress. I went into the doctor. I still complained about pain, and he said, I want to try this medicine that we've never tried with you before and see if it's effective. And this medicine, when I talk about it now, everyone knows what it was, but 20 years ago, no one had ever heard of fentanyl. And so he prescribed me fentanyl, and this was a transdermal patch, which gave me a 24-hour supply of it into my bloodstream. And the fentanyl, literally a carbon copy of the opioids in pill form, it worked really, really good, super effective. It's bad stuff. Fentanyl is bad stuff. And I got hooked on that stuff so bad. And it just, the same thing happened. I just couldn't get enough. It never worked like it used to.
Was the point to make you not feel the pain, or was the point to kind of help with EDS?
There would be no helping. You know, this was just pain management. And, you know, I talk about the drugs all the time, but there were other things going on for pain management, a TENS unit where they would send electrodes through the nerves. I mean, it wasn't like they were just trying to dump pills in me. There was other things, but of course the TENS unit and electro stuff and stim and stuff like that, those aren't very addictive. And that same cycle. And I grew up in a very conservative Christian household. I never saw my parents drink, smoke, only swore when they were really, really mad. And I don't know, you know, I was too young for the party scene. We got married too young. We started a life at 19 and 20. So I kind of missed all that. Yeah. But one night on the way home from work, I hadn't slept in about 5 days. Nights were the worst. With EDS, when you lay down, your muscles kind of go lax, and all the structure that's holding everything in just kind of turns into jello. And that's, you know, when you start hitting those nerves, especially like in your armpit and stuff. Nighttime was awful. I just wanted to sleep. I stopped at a liquor store. I was so nervous. I almost threw up a couple times going in there because I didn't want anyone seeing me. And I picked up a bottle of vodka. And that night I came home. I took a handful of pills before I went to bed, popped it in my mouth, and I washed it down with an entire liter of vodka. And I blacked out. And I wish I could say that I woke up the next morning with alcohol poisoning. I was severely sick and I learned my lesson, but that became my new routine. Just about 3/4 of a liter of vodka every single night of my life after that day, without taking a day off. And that became my routine. As many pills as I could get, I learned ways to get them. Of course, things weren't computerized then, so I could get paper scripts and pay cash. And along with the alcohol. Go ahead.
I was going to say, what was the reasoning behind you doing that the first time that you were like puking? You were so nervous of doing it. What was your initial reasoning?
The initial reasoning for getting the alcohol?
Yeah, because it seemed like you were reluctant to do it.
Yeah, well, I was reluctant because, well, one, you know, we were teaching Sunday school. We ran youth group. I mean, this was not what people I hung around with did. Like, it wasn't like we were partiers, and I'm like, you know, alcohol in my world was a bad thing. And So I had a lot of guilt, a lot of shame that was attached to it. I knew I was doing something wrong. I knew I shouldn't have been doing that, especially, you know, mixing everything with alcohol on top of it. But that need to escape, that need to, you know, try to get comfort in places that really never gave me comfort, that kind of temporary, you know, that's really what it came down to, looking back, is just finding this temporary escape, you know, from reality.
Can I ask?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I think most people, I'm curious what it was for you, because most people, when they're looking for comfort, they're going to lay down and relax. And ultimately, that was a thing that would, I think, cause you some pain. So was there any position that you could be in that you could not experience this pain?
So the weird thing about EDS, well, I shouldn't just say EDS. I think chronic pain, when you can get one thing calmed down, another thing gets highlighted. So when you have multiple issues, what would happen for me is, like, I'd get ice packs on my knees because my knees were just so inflamed. We can talk about where a lot of that inflammation was actually coming from. You know, I get that, and then all of a sudden, you know, my lower back would just start aching. And then you just chase this thing. It's like trying to plug holes, you know, in a net. You just, when you get one plugged, it just comes out somewhere else. So there was good days and there was bad days, no doubt. But I don't think there was that one position that I could, you know, if you had a bad foot or something, you could elevate it. No, I don't think so.
Yeah. So how did it go from there, from you getting from that place to ultimately going up to 400 pounds?
So, yeah, and it's weird because that's actually the next thing I was going to talk about, these escape mechanisms. I found fast food became one of those drugs, right? Like, I felt like it was all the same reactions. I would sit in line at Burger King waiting to get my breakfast sandwich. It literally felt like I was just getting a prescription filled. I get that little flutter in me and like a little happy, you know, the anticipation of happiness. I'd get up there, I'd get my food, you know, I'd take a few bites. It would taste delicious. And in 3 minutes later, the food's gone. There's a greasy wrappers on my seat. And I'm like, what did I just do to myself? You know, and food became an escape. And what's weird is, like, I always talk about that with fentanyl and with alcohol, but it's virtually the same signaling happened in my brain, you know?
Yeah.
And what's interesting about food is, you know, for me, like, obviously now that I'm in recovery, like, fentanyl is a non-issue for me. It's not anywhere I can get it. It's same with alcohol, but food is everywhere, you know? And that, to me, that addiction is harder in many aspects. Now, obviously the withdrawals and stuff aren't anything like fentanyl, but food is tough because you have to eat. you know, and it's everywhere, constantly bombarded with it. So as a result of, you know, the lack of movement, the poor food choices, I was eating fast food, you know, most of the time, two or three times a day. And we ate out a couple times. Very rarely did we cook at home. You know, with new family, new kids, super busy. It was box foods, Totino pizza rolls, you know, fried chicken in the box, and pizza, wings, and fast food. And that became, you know, my new diet, along with the drugs, along with the alcohol, along with the inactivity. My weight just spiraled to over 400 pounds. And the day I learned my weight was 400 pounds, standing on the scale, the nurse would, you know, I swear they start like at 200 just to make the process longer. But every single thing, I'd see it go up. And then finally she got to the 350. She slide in, hit the end. And she just put two X's in the weight. And I remember like, oh my gosh, like what did I do? But at the same time, it's like, now the doctor doesn't know how much I weigh, so he's not going to know how much I'm gaining. We don't know how much over 400 I got. My doctor says I was well over 400. I don't know what that means. So in any event, my weight became 400 pounds. But I think more importantly than the weight aspect, because that's what people see. And if you see a before picture of me, I was huge. But I was sick too. Like my blood pressure was out of control. My metabolic numbers were off the charts. You know, I was on two different blood pressure medicines. I was on over 20 prescriptions per month at one point or another, somewhere around 20, sometimes lower, sometimes higher. But, you know, aside from the pain pills, I was really sick. I would lay down at night and put the remote for the TV on my chest, and my heart beat so hard that every beat, it would get air. You could actually see space under that remote. I remember sitting there just watching. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of weird. I had got to the point my kidneys had shut down multiple times, and I was too embarrassed to go to the doctor because I knew why they were shutting down. I was sick, and I was going to die, and I was going to die pretty quick. I wouldn't have made it for sure another year at that point.
Did you have wake-up moments throughout it, or was the only one when you got to that scale and you weighed over 350 ultimately? Was there ever moments throughout the process of you getting there that you're like, shit, this is getting too far out of control?
No, no. And I wish there was. I wish, because I had in my head that I had this thing and I justified everything for it. You know, I like, you know, going back to the spiritual side of things, like I would sit there, hey, there's someone having a glass of wine with their spaghetti. We should put them on the prayer list, as I'm just getting blackout drunk, you know, literally in my closet at night, because I had justified my behavior because of my situation. So, no, like I didn't need a wake up call. This wasn't my fault. These are the cards I was dealt. And yeah. And 400 pounds didn't really, I mean, that made me feel bad. It made me feel, you know, terrible. And I think at some point I went from trying to numb or escape pain, physical pain. And I think very early on, if I was honest with myself, that physical pain went to an emotional pain and maybe even a spiritual pain. And now you're trying to numb emotions. And the more I would numb emotions, the more guilt I would get. And the whole thing would just, you know, it would just snowball. And the thing is, like, we look at people that are over 400 pounds and you see this physical thing, but what you don't see is when a basketball rolls by you because your daughter is playing a basketball game at school and you can't pick the ball up to throw it back. You literally got to watch it. Or that same daughter, you know, when she's 3 years old, jumps out of the car and takes off running towards a busy road, and you physically can't go catch that kid. You're just hoping that your wife's going to grab her. Like, that's hard. Yeah. Like, that's hard. I couldn't be a good dad and I couldn't be a good husband because I just didn't have the capacity at the weight and in the physical shape I was in. So no, I didn't have wake up calls because I had so perfectly designed this environment for myself that this wasn't my fault, you know?
Let me ask you a question from your wife's side, just because a lot of people listening, again, may be in the situation that you were in before, but I know for a fact we have a lot of caregivers that are caring for someone that is going through something, whatever it may be. How was that for your wife to kind of see you go down that path? I'm sure you're hiding it well to a certain extent, but like how was that for her from what she shared with you?
Yeah, so she's done a bunch of interviews on this, and it's hard for me to watch now that I'm on the other side. And I think if she was here, she would tell you that there's this balance, right? Like I was sick, you know, and we knew I was sick, and I think she justified my behavior kind of like I did. She was more sympathetic towards me than anything. She never got mad. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you, by rights, man, I have the best wife in the world. Like, she should have been gone. She had every right to walk away. I was manipulative. I lied. You know, I made her do stuff like with manipulating prescriptions and saying she dropped them in the toilet and going to beg the doctor because we're going on vacation. Like, I just had her for this pawn to get what I wanted.
Yeah.
It was awful. But I think if you ask her, she didn't know what to do. You know, she didn't know what to do.
Yeah. She just wanted to be there, love you, and support you in every way that she could. I get that.
Yeah. And the truth is, like, if you're a caretaker for an addict, even a food addict, whatever kind of addict that is, like, nothing you can say is going to snap that person out of it until they want to change. And that, I know I don't want to go down this road, but as a father, that's hard. That's hard to deal with, that you can't say anything to a child or a loved one to knock them out of addiction, especially after you know what the road entails. It's hard.
Yeah. So what would be the solution in that scenario? Just let them kind of live their own journey and monitor them?
Well, yeah, but I think there's more than, I think there's a lot we can do that maybe seems unrelated, but it's actually very helpful. And I think the biggest thing that we can do is, first of all, love the people without letting them take advantage of us, right? And without enabling them. We can also, it's going to sound weird, but we can also live our life to the absolute fullest. You know, I think, you know, whether it's veganism or whatever your religion is, a lot of times that we want to like try to convince people to do what we do. But the truth is,
yeah,
if we live and they look at us and say, what the heck does that person have that I don't have? I need whatever you got. I need that. That, yeah, to me is the biggest persuasive tool that we have in our toolbox.
Yeah, that's how I do everything. be a shining light, and then people will be attracted to it.
Yeah, and that's a lot easier to talk to people. You know, it's hard, and it's hard to get that mindset when you're dealing with someone, you know, like me for addiction. I mean, half of my life I spent, you know, at home puking with her having helped me, but the truth is, like, when they would go somewhere, there was that little thing in my head that said, man, I wish I could go. But because we got to the point we couldn't even go on family trips anymore. I couldn't be in the car for more than 30 minutes or I would just start vomiting because everything was always spinning. I was just always so high. So do you want to know how I got where I am now?
Yeah, I'm curious as to, like, what was the pivotal point for you? Like, what was the accumulation that got you to a place of, like, shit, I need to change?
Yeah, so I wish I could go back and rewrite my story and have this aha moment, light switch come on. But that didn't happen. And I think for me, it was like a series of dominoes that kind of tipped over. And the first domino for me, it came from one of the hardest tragedies that I've ever been through. And, you know, because Heather and I started dating so young, her mom was like a second mom to me. She had this kind of flu thing going on. She just didn't feel right, and she wasn't going to get it checked out. We finally convinced her to go to the doctor, and she was diagnosed with leukemia that day. Mm. And man, did that flip our world upside down. That became, instead of seeing who's going to go to practice with which kid, it became who's staying overnight with mom at the cancer hospital. And I think one of the first dominoes that tipped for me, it wasn't food and it wasn't recovery. It was gratitude. And the gratitude came at quite a price, because I'll never forget going into that hospital and seeing. So her mom was in some experimental chemo. So she was actually in the pediatric wing. You see these little kids, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10 years old. They got bald heads.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh man, these kids got leukemia and their parents got to deal with this. And I'm like, man, I have healthy kids and all I do is complain, but I got healthy kids. I'm not down here waiting for experimental drugs for my children. And yeah. One day I went up into Heather's mom. I called her Mobby. I went up into Mobby's room and she was waiting for a blood transfusion. She was so tired. And she opens her eyes super slow and she says, "How's your knee?" And it just crushed me. You know, she's days away from her death and she's wondering how my knee is. And she wondered that because all I did was complain about my knees and my joints and what I didn't have. And why did I get all these cards dealt? And all I did, you know, even when I prayed, it was always like, "Give me, give me, give me." And it was never taking the time to think, you know what? I'm walking out the door of that hospital and I have a knee, maybe a little janky, but someone's going to get their leg lobbed off tomorrow from a tumor. And they'd do anything to get my sore knee. And I got to go home that night. And there were hundreds of people that would never leave that hospital. So I think the first domino for me was a domino of gratitude. I started seeing life a little different that day. And it's a practice. You know, I still struggle. You know, it's something I have to consciously be aware of. And so Heather's mom, we're dealing with that diagnosis. And my dad, I had a cold that just wouldn't go away. And we thought he had pneumonia, got him to the doctor. They took an x-ray of his chest. And my dad was diagnosed with stage 4 kidney cancer that had metastasized through his whole body. It was loaded in his lungs. My dad was my best friend in the whole world, man. He was my best buddy. We did everything together. We hunted together. We fished together. We built stuff together. We grew gardens together. He was my best friend in the whole world. And here are the doctors giving him 6 months to live. And my dad didn't make it 6 months. He made it 6 weeks to the day of his diagnosis. And he lost his battle with cancer. And I think sitting at his funeral, I think another domino tipped for how precious life really is, right? Like, you know, we pay it lip service. We say we're not promised tomorrow. But I don't think we really understand that, because sometimes we just talk about it. But seeing my dad, you know, getting buried, it's like he's gone. And I think that was another domino that, you know, we're not promised tomorrow and life is indeed precious. Shortly after we buried my dad, Heather's mom lost her battle with leukemia that then turned to lymphoma and ultimately a brain tumor. Would take her life. And it was awful. You know, it was two of our favorite, most precious people in the world just snuffed out. And it was bad. And I don't know what was particularly special about this day, but I came down to the kitchen table. We're trying to get life kind of back to normal after all the funeral plannings. And Heather was putting my socks and shoes on me. She slid a sock up on my leg. She tapped the side of my legs. And when our eyes connected, I couldn't stop thinking about another funeral. It's weird because I had thought about what life would look without me. I knew I wasn't going to be around much longer. But for some reason, I was hung up on, like, how is she going to plan this funeral? Because we just went through all this. You have to go. I mean, it's awful. Like, you know, put the obituary in the paper, choose the casket, do the brunch. And I'm like, she's going to have to do all this. And I said, not only that, she's going to have to then raise two kids alone. And honestly, I didn't say a word to her about it. I just thought about that all day. And I went to bed a lot of nights not knowing if I'd wake up. I don't know that I cared one way or another. But I did not want her to have to go through another funeral this close to the other two. So really, my goal was just to die a little further away, to get space between these funerals. I had no intention of getting healthy or getting active or even losing weight. I just didn't want to die this soon. You know, and just, you know, with Dad passing away and stuff, man, that really ramped up the, you know, the escape factor. And I was off the rails. Yeah. But yeah, so I think as the domino started tipping, I said, I have to do something. So I did what every intelligent person does. They go to Dr. YouTube and just find some influencer telling you how to fix yourself. And that's what I did. And I found this guy. To this day, I can't find the video. I don't know. I don't even remember what the guy's name was, but I watched this video of this guy that lost. He was just as big as I was. He lost a bunch of weight, and he did it with this thing called bariatric surgery. So this is back in the Yellow Pages day. I opened the Yellow Pages up. I found a company in Buffalo. I called them up, and they sent me this giant packet in the mail. I had to go for a couple seminars. I had everything in order, and all I had to do was get my doc to sign off on it. And I saw this doctor almost every 2 weeks because I was always there for something. And I got into the doctor's office that day. The nurse took my blood pressure, and it was 255 over 115. That was on two different blood pressure medicines, and my pulse was like over 125. The doctor's freaking out. He thought I was going to have a stroke. He was calling 911. I negotiated with him, and he let me just lay on the exam table while he saw a few patients, and, you know, my vitals came back down a little bit, and he denied the surgery. He said, one, your heart's too messed up. He goes, two, with all the narcotics you're on, I don't know what's the anesthesia. You know, I don't know what the effects are going to be for that. And he said, yeah. Three, I don't know if you lose weight this fast, what's going to happen to your skeletal system too. So he denied the surgery, and I was devastated. I thought this was it. I thought I was going to be making a YouTube video a year later. And I came home just mad, just frustrated, just angry. And I went to bed that night, and I could not stop thinking about Heather's mom. Because I remember when she got the brain tumor, it was visible. And she was going in, we're dragging her in for radiation. And finally the doctor says, Carol, why are you doing this? And she looked at him and she said, I just want to be here for my family. And I couldn't get that out of my head that night. And I'm like, man, I got to do something just out of respect for her life. I'm wasting my life. And here this woman is willing to go through hell to live one more day to be with her family. And I'm just tossing mine away. So I started doing, well, I guess you'd call it keto today. It was Atkins back in the day, and I got on this Atkins thing, and I found I could eat all the chicken wings and cheese I wanted, and that was right on my alley. And I did lose some weight, but I also knew that I was feeling like crap. My cholesterol was already, you know, over 300, and I was on Lipitor, and it was climbing. My triglycerides were going nuts. So I started making changes in my diet. The one thing, you know, I look back and say, well, I did everything wrong, but I only did one thing right. And that was really the only one thing I needed. I saw a connection to what I was eating. I was eating all the wrong things, but I saw a connection to what I was eating. It had an effect on my body. And that was a new thing for me. You know, eating was pleasure, 100% pleasure. So I think that was another domino. It sounds weird to hear a plant-based, you know, person say, yes, going keto was a big domino that tipped for me because I had a recognition of this connection. And I, for some reason, dude, I don't believe in coincidence. This is totally out of character for me. I was a Harley, race cars, hunting, fishing, deer meat. I asked Heather if she had a notebook, and she goes, yeah, I got this one. And there was a few pages used. I tore the pages out. And I sat down, I had heard a song that day, and I wrote down, this is the first day of the rest of my life. I put the date at the top, and it looked pretty empty. I didn't really know what to do. So I just put, I'm thankful for my family. And I'm like, that's still not enough. I got to do something else. And I kind of wrote down a menu, and it looked like this. It looked like mozzarella sticks. It looked like turkey burgers. You know, I thought I was being healthy, probably some Greek yogurt in there. And then at the bottom of the page, I put chair times two. And his chair times two was the exercise I was going to do for the day. And what happened was I was in my office and my legs could not pick me up. So I would use my arms and I pushed down on the chair and I broke both arms right off the chair. I was so humiliated. And one of my colleagues pushed up another chair. He goes, that thing has seen its better days. He went and put it in the dumpster and gave me a new chair. And when I wrote that chair times two, I thought, you know what? If I can get out of a chair one time, I can do it twice. So every time I stood up in my office, I'd sit back down, stand back up. It doesn't sound like a lot, you know? It doesn't sound like a lot at all. But I was actually doubling
starting point
my activity.
Yeah.
And, you know, and at the end of the day, I figured, well, I got to go back to this journal and write something. And I said, you did good. And that was it. That was the start of like a mini celebration for me. And I don't know why I'm getting so emotional. I'm sorry. I've done this so many
times.
Dude,
I've been trying not to cry since earlier.
Yeah.
You talk about cancer and people passing away. It's too recent for me, but yeah, you're a good storyteller. So yeah, no, you can continue. Sorry. I'm just, if I don't see it as emotional, I'm trying not to cry.
So yeah, so I said I did good, and I didn't realize the importance of just saying I did good, because my entire life was just, I was stewing on failure, you know, just one failure built on another. And then even if I would have a win, I wouldn't look at it because I'd rather just have the self-hate and loathing. But I recognized that I did good that day. And I put my weight down there. Then the next day I would do, you know, I had trouble getting upstairs. I'd have to go up three or four stairs and kind of turn and sit down, catch my breath and go back out. So I was starting in a pretty big deficit. But little by little, you know, I just kept being thankful every day. And I sat down on the couch one night, turned on Netflix, and I saw this film called Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead. And, you know, Joe Cross, if you haven't seen that film, it's a great film, but Joe Cross comes to the U.S. from Australia, and he consumes nothing but fruit and vegetable juice for 60 days, loses a bunch of weight, inspires a bunch of people, gets off a bunch of meds, and I'm like, I don't care what he's doing, I just want what he has. And I ordered a juicer, and I'll tell you, I didn't do vegetables. You know, I didn't even think about what I was going to put in that juicer, but it sure wasn't going to be vegetables. Yeah. And you know, so January 1st, it'll be a little over 11 years ago, that juicer came in the mail. And I had to learn how to shop. I had to learn how to get produce. I had to, you know, learn to go to farmers markets and to produce companies. And I went on a 30-day juice fast, and the first 3 days were absolute hell. The fourth day, my hunger kind of subsided. Yeah. By the fifth day, no one believes me. Every time I tell this, I got goosebumps all over me. The fifth day, a miracle happened, really. I woke up in the same exact position that I had fallen asleep in. And, dude, that's all I wanted to do with all the drugs, all the alcohol. I just wanted to sleep. And it happened 5 days into this thing. And, you know, as time went on, I'd wake up with eyes that weren't so cloudy. And I would, you know, lose a little bit of that sleep apnea. I'd forget to take some of my meds. I started feeling better. The color came back in my face. My complexion started getting better. And, you know, by day 20, I was just feeling fantastic. I was bored sitting watching TV. But at the same time, I also realized I can't juice the rest of my life. So because I watch Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead, Forks Over Knives pops up in my queue. And I watched it. And when I was finished, I was angry. I was so angry. I'm like, we just buried our two favorite people, and you're telling me you can turn cancer cells on and off with casein?
Yeah.
Why didn't no one tell us this? Why didn't anyone suggest that, you know, my mom eat some fresh fruit instead of hot dogs and fish sticks? Like, no one told us this. Like, I was angry. So I said, this either has to be total BS or somebody should go to prison, really. But the one good thing about Forks Over Knives, I learned that I could eat what I was juicing along with some legumes and nuts and seeds and starches. And I basically had my new diet. And it's been, you know, 11 and a half years since I've consumed animal products, and I'll never go back, you know, never go. I mean, I have deers I killed tattooed on me, and I speak at animal sanctuaries for birthday parties for cows. So, yeah. So, the activity stuff is a whole nother thing, but yeah, and the reason why this stuff works for me, looking back, we don't have time to get into all this, but I basically went from immobilizer, like leg braces that were immobilizers, you know, to taking my first walk, which was absolute hell. I didn't understand why you'd walk for no reason. You know, that's Heather's fault. And we took a walk, and I hated every second of going and recovering, but something in my head wanted me to finish that walk that I DNF'd. And, you know, a walk on a weekend, you know, became starting to hike. Everything the doctors told me not to do, hiking would go so far. And you know, we signed up for a Tough Mudder. And before I knew it, you know, I was starting to jog a little bit. And then me and Heather ran our first 5K. And it was a beautiful thing, man. It was just beautiful. And on the way home, I kind of gave her a nudge. And I'm like, how about a 10K? She goes, I almost threw up. She goes, I'm not doing a 10K. You know, a couple months later, we ran our first 10K together. And on the way home, I gave her another nudge. And I'm like, hey, what about a half marathon? She said, you're crazy. I'm done with this. And on my dresser, I had my handicap parking permit that I'd had for years. It was like my security blanket. And I didn't need it anymore, so I set it on my dresser. I don't know why I saved it, but I noticed that the expiration date was in September, and that happened to be the same month that our big local half marathon in Niagara Falls was here. And I said, man, wouldn't it be cool to park in a handicap spot legally when I run my first half marathon? I took that half marathon badge, and I taped a picture of her mom and my dad on it and my family. I punched a hole in that thing, tied it around my waist, and I finished my first half marathon with that thing dangling around my waist. That was another one of those dominoes. And then I got into climbing mountains and cycling long distance. And from there, it's, you know, Ironmans and ultra races. And but I think what happened, I know the food I was eating with EDS, you know, was just full of inflammation. The processed food, the oils, the sugars, all that stuff. And now I'm, you know, not only getting rid of them, but I'm eating dark leafy greens and black beans and lentils and fruits and vegetables and all stuff that's alive. It's driving the inflammation out of my joints. I didn't have as much pain as I thought was from the EDS. 90% of my pain wasn't actually from EDS. It was actually from the inflammation around my injuries. So once the inflammation started driving out of my body, once I started walking and getting more fit, my muscles started taking over where my joints were weak. And I am an EDS patient. I could pull on my wrist and pull my hand. It would be gross if you saw that. But I have a 500-pound deadlift. I'm missing 5 bones in my back, and I have a fused ankle, and I can still pull 500 pounds, which if people didn't know, that's a pretty good deadlift, I think.
It is a pretty good. I've done it. It hurts.
Yeah.
How does that work though? If you pull on your finger, or you can pull on your hand, but you're holding 500 pounds as pulling your arms on the ground.
Yeah, no wraps either. I do that all raw, no belt, no wraps. I don't do that much anymore. I got smarter, and I have a nice little gym in my basement. I go much lighter. I just keep it under a couple hundred pounds. But yeah, so the idea there is you can't let, I mean, you know, if you pick up 2 buckets, right, and you get tired, you start letting them hang, you know, now you're relying on your joints rather than your muscles. So when I do stuff, even when I run, if I stand up, you push my knees, they wobble all over the place. My kneecap will be behind my knee. When I run, I almost picture like Forrest Gump in braces, like just on a train track.
Yeah.
Kind of. Trail. I did trail running for what? In fact, I ran a 50-mile trail run. Trail runs are probably not the best for me when you got to cut around a lot. But you know, there's more. So I had some issues with EDS over the past couple of years that have been rocked my world, but we don't need to talk about that. I still have EDS. Plants do not get rid of everything. They can't grow new limbs and they can't get rid of EDS, but they sure make life easier. So super quick, because this is a vegan podcast. So how do the animals all come into this? When I envisioned, growing up, I was taught animals are commodities, and it's kind of funny when sometimes we get so angry with people because they don't see what we see. But when you're raised and that's all you know, there was a difference between a dog and a cow because that's how I was brought up. But now, you know, being on the other side of it, I'm like, yeah, how stupid. We literally have a sanctuary. I won't say where it is or the name of it is. They're doing a meat raffle. And I'm like, are you guys idiots? And so you can see all these people chiming in on their Facebook. And it's like, well, there's a difference. I'm like, how? How are you rescuing one cow but slaughtering another one to gain money? So bottom line is this. I went at this 100% for health. But as my journey continues, obviously it's better for the animals. The little farm I grew up on is not where your meat comes from. I mean, it's awful conditions. These factory farms are disgusting. They're awful.
Yeah.
And it's better, you know, obviously for the environment. And one thing that people don't talk a lot about, it's better for the economy. So, and I have some slides somewhere where I went to my insurance company in 2009. The insurance company paid over $20,000 just for pharmaceuticals in 1 year for me. 1 year, $20,000. It's like 19-something. Mm-hmm. When I transitioned to Whole Food Plant-Based, I asked them in 2000, I believe it was 15 and 16 combined. They combined the 2 years because there was nothing on the 1 year. $127 for vitamin B supplement that I could have got over the counter, but I figured they should pay for something. Yeah. We understand the compound effect. We don't have a healthcare crisis. We have a food crisis. And if this is 100% repeatable, I mean, 20 grand just on pharmacy. I'm not even talking about the emergency room visits, the doctor visits, none of this. This is literally just more medicine that I went to the pharmacy and got. Imagine that's repeatable. What we could do for our economy. It's mind-blowing that we could actually have money to spend on stuff that actually matters, getting people, you know, more maintenance and buy people sneakers instead of painkillers, you know?
Yeah, but and ultimately, it's 20 grand a year, man. That's a little over $1,000 a month spent, right? Like roughly, like slightly under two. That could have gone, if you won't even spend that much on groceries if you're eating whole food plant-based. Like that, the grocery bill would be a lot cheaper than the medicine bill, and you would save on the medicine as well.
Right. Yeah, 100%. So that's kind of my story in a nutshell. I think we're good on time.
Yeah, no, that was beautiful. So there's a bunch of times where I was trying not to cry. So I definitely want to, first of all, I appreciate you for sharing. That's a beautiful story. I purposefully didn't listen to your full podcast episodes because I wanted to hear it for the first time and be able to ask like genuine questions. I also want to make sure that we talk about your new book, because I know you spent a lot of time and effort into that. And I know it's going to be live when people are going to be listening to this podcast episode. So do you mind kind of sharing what the book is about and where people can find it?
Yeah, the book, the book is, oh my goodness, it's got to be about a 6-year project. I kept putting on the shelf. It's hard to go back. You know, I think I have myself so in tune because I've done so many talks. I'm speaking to a high school actually in 2 days. And I've done this so many times, I can almost, well, within reason, almost separate my emotion and just blast through it. There was something about writing it. It's hard. Like, it's hard. And I would write some and I'm like, people don't need to know this. And finally I got to a point where I either have to be 100% authentic or don't write the book. And for a while I'm like, well, then I'm not writing the book. Like, that's how you're going to play. I'm not writing the book. So yeah, it's not the funnest thing to talk about, waking up in your own urine night after night after night. And so much so that you start putting towels under you because you know it's what's happening. And I wrote about some really dark times, but I feel like if it helps one person that's in that same hole I was in. I tell people that I actually needed a ladder to get to the bottom of my hole. I was down there so low. So the goal of my book was to give people hope. I didn't really have any other goals than that, just to write about perspective. So it's not a diet book. It's not a plant-based book. It's not a fitness book. It's not a recovery book. It's really a book about perspective, because I think perspective for me almost killed me. But perspective, when I changed it, it gave me a completely new life. So I think it's important. But all that said, so this book, I don't know. It was a lot of work, and I hope people appreciate it. And it's just basically a story of my life with lessons along the way. You know, what I went through and what I learned. And I think a lot of people struggle, you know, in secrecy like I did. I mean, my colleagues, like, they had no clue. I mean, they obviously knew I was over 400 pounds and I couldn't walk, but you know, they didn't know that what I was doing. I mean, I could have got any time I got in a vehicle, I could have got a DUI because I just always had that much alcohol in my system. And I only drank once a day. I only drank at night, but man, I made it count, you know? So I basically go through my story and I talk a little bit about addiction and stuff. And I give little lessons about, you know, comparison and all the things that were in my head. And yeah.
Yeah, I think perspective is the thing that brought you there, but also the thing that saved you, right? I feel like you didn't really use those words, but it sounded like more like the victim mentality before. Like, why is this happening to me?
Right.
I'm stuck. I can't change anything. And then I think gratefulness is a shift in perspective as well, because your environment was the same to a certain extent without the bad news. But then you're looking at your situation from a different angle.
100%. Yeah. And you know, the beautiful thing about that is that's something everyone can do. And I write about that too. It's like, it doesn't matter where you are. You have the ability to shift your perspective because there's always someone that would trade all your problems in a heartbeat. And that's how, you know, when you get this, it's kind of weird. You get this like egotistical feeling that you're the worst person, like you got it the worst. And it's like, no, when you really look out there, it's like, you know, I got a lot to be thankful for. But perspective, it's so freeing because it's a choice. And I think we always need to know that we have a choice, you know, and we can choose a good perspective.
Yeah, it's interesting how humans fight to like say that they have it the worst. Like, people will like she take a stand, like, no, I feel shittier than you do. I'm more depressed than you do. Like, you don't understand how hard I have it. But yeah, it is a freeing statement to also just be able to, I feel like the majority of people just look back on their life, like where they were 3 years, 4 years, five years ago. I'm sure they're very grateful than they are where they are today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it easy all the time, right? It's a simple concept. It's not always easy. But it's always
available. Shall pass.
Yeah.
All the
so good, yeah, that's the a little bit about pass, my book. It's called Escape, Breaking Free from a Self-Made Prison, and it's available on Amazon. I did the audiobook, which, believe it or not, the audiobook was a lot harder than the written book. It was a lot harder for me to read it back, and I was kind of surprised. The stuff that I had trouble writing about in the beginning, that wasn't that hard, because I think I had come to grips with all that stuff. But it was the good stuff. Like, about halfway through the book, everything shifts. And I start, you know, I have this one chapter called Adventure is Out There. And all these wonderful things, you know, I talk about. So I told you that Heather had to put my socks and shoes on me. And I frame it that I got to return the favor and help her, because she was struggling to get her backpack on. And but this time we were 6,700 feet in the air, because we just summited it. Mount Washington together. And that stuff, like bringing all that stuff up. Oh man, I was in you know, I can't cry through my audiobook, so I'd have to cut it, re-roll it. But so many good things, you know, I'm so blessed. I've had so many cool experiences and running Leadville and meeting Bart Yasso and running with Scott Jurek. Yeah. I mean, hanging out with a prince of Saudi Arabia and It's just, I look back and I'm like, dang, all I did was eat an apple. You know, it's so wild. But yeah. Yeah. So I'm super blessed. I'm super grateful.
Well, it's beautiful. So where did Fat Man Rants come from at that point?
I kind of wish I could go back on that one. But so I was so excited about my food. I was so excited about it that, you know, back then I had like four friends on Facebook and we had family over and I got this big, huge bodybuilder, brother-in-law, and he's sitting at the table. I'm like, man, you have to see what I ate yesterday. He goes, I know, you posted about it. And he goes, why don't you get a blog or something? Like, I'm like, what's a blog? So I Google what's a blog. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to start a blog because my friends and family are sick of hearing about my food. So I'm going to go where someone can actually want to hear about it. And I didn't, I was wanting something with like former fat guy or something. And all the domains were taken. So I had three. I took them to work to one of my colleagues. She grabbed the post-it that said Fat Man Rants because I'm always ranting when I teach. And that became a thing 9 years ago. So you know, we grew our channels, you know, somewhere in all the channels. We got a couple hundred thousand followers and there's no turning back from Fat Man Rants now. So,
yeah, rebranding, you know, would be hard at this point.
Yeah. But I feel, you know, I feel more importantly, and now that Heather was not plant-based till about 2 years after I was, and she saw what it was doing to me, which is another thing, take us all the way back to the beginning. You know, I never pushed anything on her. I think she thought this was going to be a little temporary thing, but after she saw how I was feeling and how excited I was, and I'm out walking and enjoying being outside, you know, she started stealing my food, really. They'd get pizza and I'd have sweet potatoes and she started stealing my sweet potato cubes. And, you know, for a while we did I would do a veggie stir fry. They'd throw their chicken in it. And before you knew it, it was just easier to be plant-based and everyone felt better and everyone got healthier. So the whole family became plant-based. And yeah, so, you know, you never know where this Doppler effect is going to go. But I said all that to say, Fat Man Rants, everyone's like, well, what about Heather? Because now we're Tim and Heather of Fat Man Rants. I'm like, oh, yeah. I can't change that. But I like my mantra better than my domain. And my mantra is eat plants, move your body. All you got to do is a little bit more than you did yesterday. And I think that's a good way to roll because that's what helped me. So,
yeah, that's beautiful. And so for everyone listening, I'll put the links down below to be able to get the book. Check out your blog and the evolution that it's gone through over the past like almost decade now. Tim, man, again, massive thank you for taking the time to share your story with me. I'm happy we got connected through Robert, you know, a few weeks ago. Hopefully we get to meet in person, do a workout at one point, do an endurance race, not an ultra one because I'm not there yet, but just a regular endurance race.
Yeah, I'm super slow. So especially now I got a fused ankle and a couple other things going on. So, but I just
we'll do a swim forward. Yeah. We'll do a swim.
Swim. Awesome. Well, Tim,
okay. Yeah. Thank you for jumping on, right, man. I'll put all the links down below for everyone.
Yeah. And just in closing up here, just for your listeners, whoever's listening to this, you know, it doesn't matter how far you think you're gone or how much you got to take back. Like, there's always hope out there, and it's literally change is one decision away. And the only decision that matters really is the one you have to make right now. So don't overthink this. It's the same process, whether you got to lose 400 pounds or no pounds just to get healthy. Just worry about your next meal, your next plate, your next move, and let everything else take care of itself. And on that note, I will say thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, Maxine.
Thank you. Yeah, beautiful words to end on. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, be sure to rate the podcast as it helps us grow and spread our message. And if you know this will help and resonate with someone, be sure to send it their way so that they can have the opportunity to level up their life as well.